Hey guys, first episode of a new format on the Nicholas Ingle Experience, and it's called Coffee and Conversations with Champions. We've been running this with great success on the Emmett Media channel, where we are focusing on ordinary people and superstars performing exceptionally well in the sporting arena. We're covering topics like powerlifting, swimming, and we're going to be bringing in other sports. I wanted to roll this out on my show because of the success of this format on the Emmett Media channel, and I wanted to start to interview other individuals from ordinary backgrounds doing extraordinary things. So welcome to episode one of Coffee and Conversations with Champions on the Nicholas Ingle Experience. Okay. Miles, tell us about the project and the program. So,
I'm currently the communications and fundraising manager for an organization called Protect the West Coast, which is an NPO. It was formed in 2020 by a guy called Mike Slebach, who's the managing director. And he's quite a well-known big wave surfer, one of the more prominent guys out of Dungeons here in Heart Bay.
Proper big waves.
Yeah. He's one of the sort of elite of the big wave crew. And right. He went surfing up the West Coast, you know, way past Dillon's Bay, like, towards the Namaqualand. There's a couple of spots up there, a couple of little areas that are, you know, got really good surf. Some you know, that can handle quite big swells. And he went up there and he went to this one, you know, spot and down this dirt road and got blocked by these miners. They told him, no, you can't go down there. It's a prohibited area. And he started digging around.
Give me one sec. Sorry, they're just sweeping outside. I'm going to close the window. Right. Give me a sec. Sorry. Always good to edit in post. So you're saying he was stopped by the miners?
Yeah. And I did some digging and found out, no, this is a company called MSR, Australian Mining Company, or subsidiary of an Australian mining company that obtained. They already had a mine there that was as legal as, you know, it seems on the surface of it. But subsequently, the merged, no, they obtained permission to mine what they call the 10 Beach Extension, which is another section next to the mine they already had. Mm-hmm. And there were some sort of irregularities or question marks about how that happened. And so he, you know, got a bee in his bonnet and formed Protect the West Coast, which
is the mining that they do?
So, you know, traditionally they've been mining up all up the West Coast, all the way to Namibia and into Namibia for diamonds.
Okay.
And what's emerged, you know, is the sands of the West Coast, and particularly on the beaches and, you know, sort of going a bit inland. There's from north of Eland's, the Eland's Bay area is a place called Sunfelt. Mm-hmm. If you go up there, it's like being on the beach, but you're not near the coast, you know. Apparently, the ocean used to lap at the foothills of the Cedarburg Mountains many years ago.
Sure.
And that actually why the West Coast Road is the way it is, the R27, is because it follows the beach.
Right.
At the time, which is quite interesting.
Sure.
But, they mine for these minerals, zirconium. A lot of them are used in electronics applications. There's minerals that they use to put in toothpaste. It's a whole lot of, you know, there's a long list of very sort of scientific, but these heavy minerals, they're called.
Right.
And so the mining that they do is basically they dig up the beach and filter the sand and get these minerals out of the sand, extract them and process them and ship them off to sell around the world. So that's the sort of bottom line. I mean, there's a lot of them. If you want a full detail of all the different minerals that they mine, I can give you a little bit more background. Let me just Google it.
We can run through that, or we can put it sort of in the comments if that's easier for you. We can put a document through.
Let me just call up
All right, awesome.
I'm actually going to our website. And one of what, my
yeah, yeah. Yeah, sorry, one of
my tasks as the communications manager of the company of the organization is to come up with talking points for the media. Okay. I haven't quite got there yet. Okay, I actually joined the organization just after its inception, and then worked for them for about 18 months, a little longer. And then my mom passed away, so I had to sort of step aside and deal with all of that stuff. And I just recently rejoined, so I'm sort of still, that was about 6 weeks ago, so I'm still sort of catching up on everything. But sort of been tasked with all the communications, media work, as well as, you know, getting involved on the fundraising side to raise funds so we can continue our work.
Right. What is the damage that's being done? You're talking about filtering all of the beats, and I'm sure that's quite destructive for the wildlife that's living in there, your crabs and your little creatures and stuff.
Oh, look, there's, you know, the West Coast, one area under threat, for example, is the Olifants Estuary, which is near Papendorp. And that area is the second most biodiverse area in South Africa. The biodiversity is just incredible up there. And, you know, every kind of fauna and flora that's in the ecosystem is threatened by this mining. It's a particularly destructive, disruptive type of mining. It's not like they dig a hole and go deep into the ground and it's sort of out of sound, out of sight, out of mind. They basically dig it. It's like a giant toddler has gone crazy with it in the sandpit. You know, it's just they dig these holes and you know, put all the sand that they filtered in these big sort of mine dumps, and they really just carve up the whole landscape, and it just looks like a moonscape afterwards. So they're supposed to rehabilitate the each mine.
Right. That was my next question. Yeah.
Yeah. Technically, they're supposed to, but, you know, and we can't, you know, the Protect the West Coast is not anti-mining per se. It needs to be. It's quite poorly regulated, and you know, corners are cut and promises are made. And so I'm not painting all the mining companies that have been up there the whole time, or even the ones that are up there at the moment with the same brush, but there certainly are some cowboys that don't follow the rules.
Right. Is that because it's quite a remote area, so it's difficult to
police? It is. And this is, you know, this is kind of the crux of the matter, is for the guys have got away with this for so long because the West Coast is, you know, if you include Namibia, but that region is the most sparsely populated real estate on planet Earth. I think it's three people to every 1,000 square kilometers or something. It's you know, you go one step further on and you're in desert where no one lives, you know. That's basically the line. So it is extremely sparsely populated. And yeah, it's been out of sight, out of mind for decades. But now what's happening is with technology, you know, people are much more connected than they used to be. And also the region is opening up, you know, in part thanks to technology, but also, you know, tourism is growing up there. So more people are going up there and seeing, and particularly, you know, historically, surfers are kind of pioneers in travel exploration.
100%. Summer. There you go.
Exactly. That's and that was going on before that even, you know.
Yeah.
Where, you know, some of the guys that are the first backpackers, there's a guy called Dick Metz, who actually was the catalyst. He met John Whitmore back in the day and kickstarted John Whitmore's whole program. He was friends with Hobie Alter. He was, you know, probably one of the first backpackers, surf travelers in the world, traveling around the world in the late 50s and early 60s. So, you know, the surfers are the ones that have kind of explored all these areas looking for surf. I mean, there are other sort of subcultures that also, you know, head out into the remote areas, the runners, which I'll talk about in a minute, because the running community has been very supportive of what we're doing. And obviously the divers, you know, the diamond divers are kind of caught between a rock and a hard place. They're most of them are surfers, a lot of them. And so that's their livelihood. A lot of them are small operators. And so they, you know, have sided with us because they've seen it firsthand. And so what's happened is this: these lines of communication have opened up between you know, the conserve sort of Cape Town surfers who go up there and surf a lot. And I mean, that region's been surfed by like Kelly Slater, John Florence, like all these world champions have been up there. Sure. Twiggy Baker's actually on our board of directors, big wave world champion from Durban. And so they've, over the years, seen how this mining, this kind of mining has encroached further and further south. And, you know, it's then the local populations as well. And one of the mandates of Protect the West Coast is to unite the people of the region and help them to communicate with each other. Mm-hmm. Because that's the other problem, is they're all in these isolated little dorpies. They're not extremely connected, you know, but now lately, obviously, everyone's got a mobile phone. And I think that's the other thing as well. You know, the reception is improving up there. It's still not great, but there's more towers going up. So people are able to communicate and kind of mobilize and organize in a way that they haven't been able to before. And people are realizing, oh, this is going on in your town too, and in your town. You know, and it's like, okay, this is affecting everybody.
Right.
And this, you know, so when you talk about mining on the West Coast, the environmental degradation and the lack of rehabilitation are two very important points from an ecological point of view.
But what are you seeing? I mean, in terms of that, sort of like the before and after pictures.
Exactly. I mean, you go on our website and you'll see our socials. Yeah. You'll see, you know, pictures that guys have gone up there. I mean, you know, at some of them at quite a bit of risk to their own sort of freedom or safety to go and fly drones over these places, because it's you know, in terms of the constitution. You're supposed to, as a member of the public of South Africa, as a citizen of the country, have reasonable access to the coastline.
Mm.
And technically you can get to the coast, but unfortunately, because these guys have got these licenses and they've sort of, they cite health and safety as a reason that you can't go on there. So you can go on there, but you have to wear a helmet and boots and, you know, apply and do all this stuff.
Right.
There's supposed to be public access, but there isn't. And, you know, that's kind of what triggered the formation of the Protect the West Coast. But it's really not about sort of privileged surfers from the city not having access to their favorite surf spots. That's you know, that was kind of the catalyst and the trigger for it. But really, you know, once we scratched the surface and really determined, like, what exactly is going on up here, we determined that, you know, a lot of these sites have cultural San, Khoi, and Nama tribe middens and archaeological sites that are being disrupted. They are disrupting the traditional kind of pulse of movement of the indigenous population. They're blocking the artisanal fishermen from getting to the coast, and it's affecting tourism as well, because, you know, people can't go to these regions or these areas. And it's, once they, you know, do whatever they want to do and leave, you know, basically a tip behind. I mean, who wants to go and camp or do any kind of recreation in a place that looks like a moonscape that exploded, you know, like a bomb exploded on a moonscape? It's just terrible. So, you know, that's, but really, you know, for me personally as well, you know, the population up there, there's got to be a better way. And the mining companies, you know, when they criticize, they will say, oh, well, we provide jobs, we provide economic stimulus to the area. And also they support the community. But in many cases, it's there's only a few permanent jobs that are created. Mm-hmm. Most of the economic activity is they extract these minerals, put them in trucks and ship them away. And the local population don't benefit.
Right.
Benefit in very small way. And then, you know, in terms of the sort of CSR outreach, also very minimal is done. You know, if you go and scratch a surface and look at what some of these mining companies are operating in certain areas actually do for the local communities, it's almost nothing. So, you know, I think the people that live up there, you know, for a while sort of bought into that narrative and sort of, well, we need the mining companies because it brings, you know, brings jobs and it brings economic activity to the region. But I think more and more they're starting to realize that's not really the case. And also, you know, one of our focuses as an organization is to create nature-based solutions and provide alternatives, sustainable alternatives in terms of tourism and recreational sports, and also We're just about to publish a story on these guys that have got algae farms up there, for example.
Right. Okay.
So there's a lot of opportunities and for the local people for us to support them. You know, one of the projects we've got is we've got an educational project for one of the schools in one of the affected areas called Doringbai, where we're getting involved in educating the youth.
Right.
Because obviously they're the future and they're the ones that are going to be handed the custodianship of the coast.
Yes.
And they need to know what's going on, you know.
I think just to touch on that point, you know, you spoke about surfers being, fortunate surfers from the big city coming through. But I always think from what I know of the surfing culture, surfers always... They view themselves as custodians of the environment, as custodians for the next generation, for future generations. Were you mentioning that the mining is well and good in terms of saying it's creating employment, but what's it doing? What's it leaving behind for future generations? What are your concerns around that?
Well, it's leaving, you know, if done correctly, you know, there are cases, there are great examples of where, you know, mining is done according to the book, and they go in there and they do what they need to do and they rehabilitate the environment. But in most cases, what, you know, there is one thing they do, for example, is they get the mining rights. They do their mining, and then what they do is they when they get to the end of the mine cycle, they divvy it up and they sell it to smaller operators.
Mm-hmm.
And some of these smaller operators then extract what they can out of the land, and then they declare bankruptcy and they fold. And so then the rehabilitation part of the process, which bookends the end of it, doesn't happen because these guys have put their hands up in the air and said, hey, we can't afford to do the rehabilitation. We've gone into receivership and, you know, that's the end of it. So, and you know, that's part of the sort of modus operandi in those cases.
So that's all part of the plan, at your sense, in terms of.
Yeah, I think in some cases, definitely, or that's just the way it works out, you know, whether it's premeditated or whether it just ends up that way. Unfortunately, that is part of the thing. And then, you know, another thing that I'm sort of becoming enlightened with recently is that, you know, I spoke to a chief of the Nama tribe in that part of the world recently, you know, he's a mine of information, like he's just like walking encyclopedia, this guy.
Right.
And he told me about basically how, you know, from the Dutch, from Jan van Riebeck, they used to go up there and get, when the Cape Cape Town settlement ran out of cattle, they went up to the Nama tribe. They were very successful cattle herders and started to trade for cattle with them. And that's actually how many of the little dorps on the West Coast originated, as cattle stations, you know.
Okay.
And then all sorts of promises were made to them by the Dutch and reneged upon, and then the British took over and same thing happened, and then the Nats took over and same thing happened, and now the most recent government have also, you know, broken promises, sort of treaties and agreements that were made. These people are the natural custodians and sort of owners of the land, and they've just been pushed aside for profit, you know, for centuries.
Right.
So I think the empowerment of the people up there is very important. And, you know, not everyone that lives up there, that lives in sort of marginalized communities, is part of the Nama community or any of the indigenous communities. But certainly they're all interconnected. And, you know, that's definitely one of our mandates is to empower the people up there, to give them a voice.
Right.
We made a movie last year called Ours Not Mine, which, you know, was just a start. That's one of our kind of strategic objectives is media, is getting publicity in the media through our own productions, for example, our movie that we made. And then also, you know, Daily Maverick, for example, have been really supportive of us and Ground Up, and published several articles over the last 3 years, and quite a spate of them recently. And, you know, we won't take complete credit to drawing the attention to the situation up there for our efforts alone. There are a lot of other people that have been putting in a lot of work. There's a professor from UCT called Mel Soman, who's been working up there for a long time, Suzanne Duplessis, a number of other people who are affiliated with our organization, but they're not, you know, active members, that have been doing a lot of work as well. And so we've been successful in terms of our objective of connecting all these disparate activists and people that have been, you know, and we've connected everyone in a way that they've never been connected before, and then also drawn attention to the situation, not just regionally or nationally, but also internationally. You know, we've had coverage in some overseas outlets. It's one of our objectives right now is to get more coverage.
Right.
And also using the Nama, the plight of the Nama people, and particularly the people in the Richtersveld, who've been sort of shafted by an agreement that was made. I don't want to say too much, just say the wrong thing. I'm just sort of starting to get my nose into all the documents that have been sent to me. But certainly there's, you know, they have not been treated well. And, you know, just to give them more say over their land, because they've sort of been ignored over the years.
Right.
The other process that's, you know, part of our arsenal is what they call the public participation process. So basically, whenever there's the mining process takes three stages. There's a kind of reconnaissance stage. Then there's a stage where they go and they prospect. Mm-hmm. So they'll go into an area that they've identified as a potential for potential mining, and they'll go and just dig boreholes, dig small holes, and analyze the sand or the ground to see if there's enough minerals there to justify a high, you know, high enough percentage of minerals there to justify actually full-blown mining.
Right.
Once they pass that stage, and they apply for a mining license. And so there's three stages, and throughout the process is what's known as public participation process, whereby stakeholders called interested and affected parties are given a window to object. And so we, in many cases, we object as an organization, and we scrutinize the environmental impacts these guys submit.
Right.
Well, there was a case recently where it was determined that the people that were compiling, it's on Daily Maverick, the article, compiling these environmental assessments were not qualified to do so.
Mm-hmm.
There was another case where they determined that the environmental impact assessment documents that submitted for, I can't recall if it was for an application for prospecting or mining, but certainly one of the two, that they'd cut and paste documents from like 8 years before. They hadn't actually done any fresh work.
Right. Wow.
And they've been getting away with this for a long time because no one's put a spotlight on them, but now we're scrutinizing everything. So that's the one part of it. And the other part of it is just letting the public know, hey, this is going on, and anybody has a right to submit an objection.
Right.
It just can be one line. I'm a frequent visitor to the area, and I don't want to see it damaged.
Right.
Right through to what we do is we get experts and analysts and academics to actually submit like documents, and we work together with these people to submit coherent arguments against what they're doing. You know, I think that, you know, that again, there's a lot of people involved in the process that are outside our own organization. But, you know, there was one application that was made about 2 or 3 years ago where they had 4 objections submitted. And these are by these people that just, you know, object to everything because they're the ones that know about it. And then there was another one, you know, more recently that had, I think, about 25 people objected, and one of the ones that we publicized. Most recently, there was a there's been an application to mine tungsten near Pietersburg, which is, you know, tungsten mining is very disruptive to the environment in terms of dust and a whole lot of factors. Groundwater is another the use of groundwater, the contamination of groundwater. There's lots of farms around there. We publicized it quite heavily in conjunction with an organization called Friends of Verlorenvlei,
right,
who are, you know, established themselves as the custodian of the Verlorenvlei River and the Vlei down in Elands Bay, which has been practically dry for the last 10 years. For some reason, recently it's filled up and it's looking its former self again. But it's not only about the water levels, it's also about the contamination of the water itself, and how this will affect jobs, you know, because if the farms failed and all the workers on the farms and, you know, the whole local economy will suffer. But anyway, to get to the point, they had more than 750 objections, which is huge. I mean, it's like,
sure.
I don't know if it's a record or not, but it's massive. And, you know, that was a combined effort between the local activists. There's some very prominent families in the area that have hired these like high powered lawyers and advocates to fight the case on their behalf. And those individuals, plus the local community, plus Friends of Fleur and Flay, garnered the majority of those. But I spoke to the advocate that's in charge of the whole process, overseeing it for the community and the local farming people. And he said that, Protect the West Coast, publicizing it on all our social media channels, got at least 80 or 90 extra applications.
Sure. That's amazing.
They saw a spike, you know, after being publicized. So, you know, that, and they want to get it up to 1,000 now. So that's like a really great example. And obviously that's, you know, it's near Picketburg. It's a much more highly populated area, very popular area for tourism. You know, strong local economy that's based around the farming, and then obviously the tourism, and then, you know, for Fleur and Flay, that sort of catchment area is just one of the catchment areas that were affected by this mining. So I think that's drawn attention to the sort of community activism and together with strong type of sentiment.
Right.
And hopefully we can continue that effect. You know, obviously there's not as much objections and the community involvement in a lot of the applications. I mean, they wanted to mine the banks of the Olifants River estuary. I mean, it's a Ramsar World Heritage Site. It's like, I mean, it's crazy, you know?
So who is granting sort of the licenses and the go-ahead for this?
That's the DMRE, Department of Minerals and Fisheries, whatever it's called.
Right. Have you had conversation with them, interaction with them at all, or feedback?
We have.
Okay. And how is that, if I'm asked, how has that gone? I mean, I do understand if there's stuff that's sensitive to talk about, because the reason I'm asking is, in terms of tourism development and long-term benefit to the local communities, the sense that I'm getting from our conversation is that tourism would be far better for the economy and the environment long-term. It would be a better benefit for the local community than sort of coming in and mining for a few years and then moving on.
Absolutely. I haven't been that involved with the sort of direct interaction with the department. I will say that it hasn't really had any effect. I mean, one of the long-term goals of Protect the West Coast is to create a comprehensive environmental impact study.
Right.
To really determine, and you know, this is something that's been echoed by other activists. There's actually another article on Daily Maverick right now that was published about 10 days ago by an academic from UCT about the fact that what they're not doing is not looking at it holistically. So, excuse me, each of these mining applications in particular, you know, the mining applications, they also defend them saying, oh, well, it's not a mine. They're just prospecting. You know, it is somewhat disruptive. But the point is, you know, that it's a stepping stone on the path to a mine. And I'm not sure of the percentages, but a lot of these prospecting applications do end up in mining in some shape or form. And so that's the start of it. And then obviously the, you know, full-blown mining rights license that's granted to a certain area, we're starting to enter in all these issues regarding disruption of aesthetically disrupting the environment, but also ecologically disrupting the food chain and the very, very precarious ecological balances that are up there between not just the land, but also the coast, because a lot of the mining that takes place right on the coast, you know, the sand goes into the ocean and causes all sorts of problems.
And those are very, you know, rich and fertile fishing grounds for the whole of the country.
Exactly. So there is a detrimental effect, not just on the land, but also in the adjacent sea. And I don't even want to go into the oil and gas side of things, because that's also enormous, and the Kapawa ship as well. You know, that sort of falls broadly under Protect the West mandate. We're not Protect the West Coast from mining. But mining is our focus because, you know, that's something tangible. And there are other organizations that are fighting, the Green Connection, for example, the CER, and organizations like that are very active in that space. But we have published some articles on it, and it is on our radar as well. to make sure that, you know, these things, I don't think we're ever going to stop them completely.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the resources are there, but it's, you know, mainly for us is protecting the environment and protecting the integrity of the local populations to see that they're not, you know, shafted. And sorry, what was your question again?
You know, Miles, what I wanted to ask you, I mean, your background is sort of in surfing and skating, and I mean, you know, we were at school together. You were a legend. You still are a legend. With the surfing, and you know, I think it gives you a very special connection to nature. And I think even for us growing up in Cape Town. But why is this so important to you? Two questions. Why is this so important to you? And then can you give us a little bit of your background, just so that the people listening and watching can sort of get an understanding and can connect?
Yeah, good question. I mean, probably start with the second part first, like my background. Cool. I started surfing when I was 9 years old. I won't say how long ago that is, but it's a while back.
And I don't, let's just say we're still in the 70s.
Yeah, just end of the 70s. I'll say 1980, how about that?
Yeah, okay, cool, sweet, yeah.
But yeah, I can't really remember really where the sort of trigger for the environmental kind of consciousness that I developed from a really young age. I can't remember. I mean, there's an organization called Surf Rider Foundation, which is, you know, decades old. And it's probably, you know, I first noticed them in surfing magazines. You know, I grew up surfing in Hout Bay, and, you know, there's always been pollution issues here, you know, with sewage and also oil from the boats and stuff like that. So I think it was just really starting to really get a love for the ocean. I mean, I was started going up the West Coast. I was 12 years old when I did my first trip up the West Coast to Ellens Bay. Sure. And so, you know, I've seen, because development is another issue as well, you know, and I remember going to St. Helena Bay when I was, you know, in my teens, quite often to surf. And the whole point was just this, I mean, it should have been made a nature reserve. The fact that it was actually made into Shelly Beach Resort is a travesty. But it is what it is. And I remember, you know, I went to the Navy, and I think I even traveled overseas, and I came back and went surfing up there for the first time in a long, long time. And they were digging all the trenches for what is now called Shelly Point, the resort there. And just seeing how they carved up the landscape, it was just something that was just like a shock, you know? And I think probably, you know, as a teenager, I was always aware of kind of probably on a sort of subconscious level of the and it's part of surf culture, you know. We surfers are known explorers. We've broken new ground in you know, all over the world. You know, if you go and look at communities that are exposed to the world or even sprung up, very often you can trace its roots back to surfing. I mean, Jeffreys Bay, St. Francis area is a prime example. Mm-hmm. There's plenty of other places in the world as well where, you know, they were kind of backwaters until surfers started going there. Is a double-edged sword, you know, the guys bring also kind of Western capitalist, you know, pollution and all that kind of stuff. Yeah. So, you know, it's a double-edged sword, but certainly, you know, and definitely more recently, you know, there's quite a lot of organizations that if you scratch beneath the surface, you see that surfers have been either founding the organization or very instrumental in their growth. Surf Rider Foundation is the big daddy, the original one. But there's Surfers Against Sewage in the UK. And in fact, when traveling overseas in the early 90s, I ended up working in Newquay in Cornwall for a surfing magazine called Wavelength. And, you know, the pollution there at the time was horrendous, the sewage. Mm-hmm. I remember seeing, you know, panty liners and tampons go past me and just raw sewage in the water.
Sure.
And so I made a point. I was the associate editor of the only surf mag in the UK at the time called Wavelength. And we allocated a page to Surfers Against Sewage, which is a very famous, certainly in Europe and the UK, very famous surfer-run environmental organization. And their mandate is obviously fighting sewage and ocean water pollution. And they were famous for their activism. They had this giant blow-up turd that they took to the Westminster and wore gas masks, and you know, they really were quite visceral in their protests, and quite, you know, much more on the Sea Shepherd side of things, where they you know, were quite activist and kind of punk rock about it. And that was, you know, probably quite necessary at the time, where Surf Rider Foundation had a little bit more of a corporate type of legal lobbying. And so, particularly the West Coast was a bit of a mix of the two. I mean, in 2020, we had a protest up the West Coast. It was only a handful of us that were able to make it up there, but we went onto one of the mines with signs and stuff, and makes for great PR. And I always wanted to work for Surf Rider Foundation as well. Like, it was, you know, I think going to the UK, being directly involved in surfacing and sewage, you know, and making sure that they, every issue of our magazine had some coverage from them, which they weren't doing before until I got there. And then I interned at Surf Rider Foundation in Australia, when I traveled to Australia for a very short while, but it was great to, you know, see their operation and meet those guys. And, you know, I think that was the beginning of the, and then obviously traveling, you know, I've traveled to very, very remote parts of Indonesia. In the early 90s, where in fact, you know, on a Sunday afternoon, the people used to come down from the hills to come and look at us because they'd never seen Westerners before.
Right.
So that gives you an indication of how deep in the jungle we were. Yeah. Orang Putih. And they come and take pictures with us. And probably my pictures on some wall in some guy's hut in Sumbawa, you know, that they came down and met us. And it was like a big highlight for them on a Sunday to come and meet the Western surfers.
Sure, that is so cool.
But even then, you know, in the 90s, to see that, you know, we weren't immune to the pollution, and you'd see rubbish in the water. I mean, Kelly Slater actually just posted something on his Instagram about it.
Sure, I saw that.
Yeah, in Bali, you know, and it's the problem is a million times worse now than it was when I was, you know, doing my thing back in the day. But even in Bali especially, you can see, you know, the intrusion of the just rubbish everywhere, terrible. I've been to the Maldives as well. I went to an island. I did a boat trip there not that long ago, about 8 years ago. And, you know, you go to the – I've done both. I've done a boat trip and I've done the resorts in Maldives. The resorts are immaculate. But then I did this boat trip and we went to just a normal town the one day. And I honestly, I've got a picture of it somewhere. I took a picture of the harbor. It was thick. I reckon you could walk over the plastic rubbish.
Sure.
So, you know, it's always been something that's quite strong. So obviously when I heard about Protect the West Coast, and I knew Mike Schlebach from surfing, you know, Cape Town. And I spent a long time covering the big wave surfing at Dungeons for local international media when I was a surfing journalist. And so I know all the guys, you know, and Mike's a great guy. And, you know, got talking to him and he's like, we're looking for people like you to join our organization. And I was like, I'm all in. I'm there. So it was a great opportunity to take that kind of part of me and apply it, you know, and apply all those skills. And I mean, I spent 10 years in the Middle East in a corporate, semi-corporate publishing. So I've been able to take all the connections and all the skills that I've learned over the years and apply them to protect the West Coast. And you know, just going full circle back to the 12-year-old at the Elands Bay. And you know, I love the West Coast more than anything. I go up there all the time. And you know, it's heartbreaking. So it's great, really great to be able to take that knowledge and experience and apply it in a way that's going to benefit the environment and the people up there.
So what is the objective? What's the dream scenario out of this for you?
Well, one of the things we want to hope to achieve is to get a moratorium that just circles back to what I was saying about the Department of Mineral Resources applying all these ad hoc licenses without any holistic overview of the effect that it's having on the entire region. It's all just on a case-by-case basis. The environmental impacts are very localized,
right?
And don't really take into account the accumulative effect of all these mines. I mean, if this latest application to mine this area known as well, I can't actually say it's a secret surf spot. We had a little conversation amongst ourselves because this one area is not really a secret because, you know, all the pros have been there and it's been in international videos, but it's never been named.
Yeah.
It's near an area called Karukiskop, which is actually a very a area of a great cultural significance in the First Nations. And that's definitely one of the sort of arguments in our arsenal of like, look, you guys are disrupting indigenous middens and all that kind of thing. But you know, the bottom line is that if we don't stand up and make a noise about this, you know, these so-called secret spots, nobody's going to be able to go to them. So,
right.
That stretch of coast is one of the last untouched areas in the entire coastline from Eland's Bay to the Namibian border that's not been had the claws of the mining, these miners in it. And, you know, if those mining licenses are granted, basically the entire West Coast is one gone. Big mine,
okay.
Which is ridiculous.
Have and you so, got, oh, sorry, yeah.
Sorry, so just to go back to the point about objectives that are one of our overarching objectives is to create a holistic environmental impact assessment of the entire region and not just little individual areas, and bringing into that nature-based solutions as an alternative. So all the different kinds of sustainable farming, whether it's fish farming, algae farming, or any other tourism, any other kind of sustainable industry or economic activity that will bring jobs and employment and advancement to the local populations. And ultimately, we'd like to see a moratorium on mining. So no more stop everything, no more prospecting applications, no more mining applications to be granted. Let's take a step back, look at the whole picture, review the assessment and move forward with sustainable solutions.
Right.
So that's really the kind of first prize for us. And it's going to take a lot of work and a lot of effort and a lot of time to get there. But, you know, we started the process and, you know, we need support, really. I mean, you know, putting aside sort of communications and all the motivation, there's a core group of about 8 to 10 of us that are involved in Protect the West Coast, and everybody brings different skill sets. And connections and experience to these. And we've got academics, journalists, designers, social media experts, and guys in the nonprofit sector that are helping us to really create. We're about to apply for a grant for a pilot project to rehabilitate the existing mines in the Northern Cape, which will provide employment and skills, upskilling of local communities. For you know, at least 3 years, and that's just a start. Okay. That's just going into the existing mining areas and rehabilitating them with natural vegetation to the point where the ecosystems can recover, because at the moment they're just sterile.
Right.
And then take that model and expand it into as far as we can. I mean, it'd be great to see every single mine that's lying there that hasn't been rehabilitated to get it back to as close to its original state as possible, and then obviously any new mines that come along that precedent will be part, and it will be policed and it will be enforced. So that's just one of the many things, and then obviously, you know, working with tourism, working with local communities to create sustainable industries and economic activity that will, you know, last for
So I think talking on that point of the economic activity, because I think ultimately you would sell the mine to government. This is what I would think in my very naive viewpoint on this. You would sell that to government, say, we're coming in, we're going to mine, we're going to sell this stuff, but we want permission to do so because we're going to create local employment, and that's going to uplift the community and it's going to develop the community. What I'm hearing, though, just from the discussion and what my sense is, that there's no real long-term view on that in terms of sustained economic development and sustained benefit from that economic development or claimed economic development. Do you guys have any figures or any information going back on a mine that was 20 or 30 years old that mined an area, brought jobs, and then shut down and left? Has there been any sustainable development? Because ultimately I would think that's what it's for, to empower the local community and to enable sustainable long-term economic development for those regions.
Not to my knowledge. I'll get back to you on that. As far as I know, there's been nothing of any kind of notable impact along those lines. I don't think there's been anything, and data is extremely hard to come by.
Right.
You know,
I would think so.
We've got partners, associates of ours in very higher in the sort of stratosphere of academia that are trying to get information. I mean, I at the moment, one of my projects for Protect the West Coast is to try and get a accurate picture of all the mining applications, prospecting applications, mining applications, and applications that have been approved on those two levels to get a snapshot of where everything's at. And I was in contact with an academic at UCT recently, and they said it's so difficult to get information. What happened is you've got a zama-zama thing happening up in the Richterswald as well, where these decommissioned mines or dormant mines are being, these guys are coming in illegally. And we are about to put out some in the next month or two. We've been gathering a team of ours that did a trip up there last year and met some of these guys. And so that's going on as well. And then there's also, there's a lot of smoke and mirrors. You know, I stand corrected, but I have it on, you know, fairly good authority that there's, you know, basically a lot of, some of these companies, I need to be very careful, but some of these companies, no names named, are fronts for overseas money. And that these guys are, you know, saying they BBBBEE compliant and all the stuff they're South African owned, but, you know, they're not. And, you know, in the case of the tungsten mine, for example, I have it on fairly good authority that that tungsten they were mined was going straight to Sultana and straight on a ship and straight to China. Right. So, you know, in terms of local benefits, it's very minimal. And I wouldn't be surprised if there was anything, you know, that showed a remarkable or notable positive impact on the local communities. I think it's mostly, you know, not good for them.
Right.
And yeah, so that's the situation.
So how can local communities, how can our communities get involved? How can they support you? How can they help? Because you want to be able to take your grandkids and great grandkids to the West Coast.
Like, no, absolutely. And you want to, you know, you want to ensure that this natural resource, this wonderful place, you know, a lot of people look at the West Coast and they see sort of arid semi-desert, but the place is, so ecologically diverse. It's so stark. It's got its own raw stark beauty. I mean, anybody who's been up there, you know, sunrise on the West Coast or sunset on the West Coast or a lovely, beautiful day when the flowers are out. And the sea is sparkling.
Or you get through and you get to see the sea for the first time.
Just that feeling of relief. And, you know, it's like a breath of fresh air. It's just an incredibly beautiful place. And, you know, just to preserve that, even if it's not something that's, you know, necessarily that you might want to enjoy or take your kids or grandkids to, in terms of the greater community, you know, I think we all have responsibility to make sure that, we preserve that. So that's the one thing. But people, we have a mechanism, you know, people can go onto our website and then they can donate.
Cool.
Well, those funds go to ensuring that the organization can fulfill its objectives.
Right. You know, what is that website address?
It's, let me just make sure.
I'm just pulling it up. I'm going to type it up now as well. So excuse me.
Yeah. So our website is protectthewestcoast.org.
And if
protectthewestcoast.org.
Right. I'll pop that up now. Awesome. Okay, cool. And on your socials, does that look good to you? Did I spell that right?
That's the one.
Excellent. Cool.
And we're on Facebook. We've got two things on Facebook. We've got a page, which is our official organizational page.
Right.
We've also got a group called Protectors of the West Coast, which is also very active. And that is largely populated by our community, which is, you know, surfers and runners and environmentalists, but also quite a lot of local people from the local communities, you know, Innards Bay, Lambers Bay, Corner Club By, all the towns around there that are active in there, and that's one of our main communication tools with the local communities. Very active on Facebook. We're on Instagram, and LinkedIn, and YouTube.
Okay.
So you can go to our website. You can go to the contact page on our website, and all the links are there.
Okay, fantastic.
And so certainly, you know, just from your desk or from your armchair with your phone in your hand, you can go and follow all our socials and share our posts.
Cool. So that was, that was the next question. What do you need people to do? So there's donate, there's what do you need from people? So there's so the also donate.
LinkedIn, mentioned that.
Perfect, yeah.
So that's the starting point is, you know, follow us. You know, obviously when we're sort of presenting ourselves to the powers that be, that the more, we've got 11,000 followers on Instagram, which is great.
Awesome.
And that's largely a result of the international outreach that we've done. And we've been shared by, you know, a two-time world champion, John Florence. He shared our posts on his Instagram, and we got a massive spike of followers from that. So, you know, this is not just a local thing or a South African thing. This is a global thing. There are similar organizations in the world, but I don't think there's anything really quite like us, you know. There's a lot of surfer and ocean activist run organizations that cover the gamut of activism, from plastic pollution to, you know, Hurley, for example, created an organization that takes fresh water to marginalized communities around the world. So our kind of mandate is quite unique. So start by following us on socials and sharing our posts. We do sort of specific calls to action in terms of specific fundraising, but we also have a number of fundraising mechanisms where people can donate whatever they can afford to us. We have, just having a look on our website here, Give and Gain is one of our main conduits for fundraising. So you can go on there and you know, give $100 or $200 or $500 or whatever to the cause. Zapper, SnapScan, PayPal, and then there's also EFT. You can all the details are on the donate tab on our website.
Awesome.
We're also looking for institutional and you know, philanthropic sponsorship or donations, you know, large scale donations from individuals or organizations, institutions that, you know, share our goals and are interested in preserving the West Coast and uplifting the local communities. And that's something else we're working on right now. And then people can also donate their efforts. You know, we've got the email address, get involved at Protect the West Coast. We're always looking for volunteers to help us achieve our objectives. Also looking for sponsors for different, we're about to roll out a whole bunch of new initiatives. And these range from, you know, the thing that we're doing at the school in Doringbai. I must just give a shout out to Gone Outdoor and Patagonia that have been quite, you know, very supportive of us. Gone Outdoor is a South African retail store that have been extremely supportive of us. And, you know, we're looking for partners, you know, to partner with various projects. For example, we're doing a giveaway, a program soon where we've got some local businesses from the West Coast to give away, you know, a weekend in B&B and that kind of thing, which also is part of, you know, our kind of mandate is to support the businesses on the West Coast, the local economies there. And you know, create employment and stuff like that. So I would say those are the main areas that people can help us. You know, if you are as an individual, you can donate, or as a, you know, if you have a company that'd like to get involved in, you know, and we've got everything from sort of smaller scale projects that we're working on to larger projects. Like we've got another movie project in the pipeline.
Right. Where can people find the movie?
So they can find our previous movie, Ours Not Mine. It's on YouTube, and it's also on our website.
Right.
But it's on our YouTube page, and as well as some other smaller projects, movie sort of video projects that we've done, and some partner video projects.
Okay.
I think you get if you want to watch Ours Not Mine, I have a box of tissues at hand.
Right. Okay.
It's a very, very emotive movie, and really is one of the first kind of opportunities for those local communities to have their say.
Okay.
People in academia, you know, we're always looking for academics and people with great knowledge of the fauna and flora of the area to help us. We've got some great partners that we're working with, but every day new people are popping up and are able to contribute in that way as well. You know, we do have events from time to time. We've got some events coming up. We are also going to be launching, hopefully in the next couple of months, an app.
Okay.
Which is all about public participation. So that's another way that people can, you know, keep track of our social media and our website, where we always, as soon as we find out about an application, mm-hmm. whether it's prospecting or an actual mining rights application, we look into it, we publish an article, and we have a call to action for people to sign up as into the public participation mm-hmm. process, where you become interested and affected party. And then you can lend your voice to, you know, protesting to these different mining or prospecting applications.
Right.
And then, so there's all the different okay. ways that people can get involved. The people up there, I mean, for me personally, I always go back to them, because they, you know, I went to round off.
Mm.
What really brought it home for me is I went up there in 2021. There was a prospecting application to mine zirconium in mm-hmm. primarily quite close to Lamberts Bay. And there was a public meeting further north on the sort of other side of the area that mm-hmm. they're looking at mining. But then they had another meeting in Lamberts Bay itself. And there were about 150 people there. And there were farmers, there were mm-hmm. local community, there was a member of the Khoisan community there, chief, that had representing his people. You know, and it was amazing to see all these people from all these different walks of life, all these different social strata in South Africa, you know, with our history and the sort of divisive politics that have dominated us for so long. Mm. To see all the people come together with a united voice.
Right.
All sure. firmly against, you know, this mining, for all the reasons that I've said, the environmental mm. reasons, the social reasons, economic reasons. Everybody has their own reasons. You know, the farmers, for example, are particularly concerned about the groundwater, beach access for the fishermen, pollution, dust, you know, you name it. You know, all these people were concerned, and obviously all the environmentalists, they're concerned about the ecosystem, all speaking with one voice and very, very vocal against these guys that were standing up there trying to, you know, convince the community that it was a good thing for the community. And the community was just like, no, we're not having it. So, you know, that was great to see. And I think, you know, that really hammered home for me, you know, having been involved in the organization for about a year by then. It's, you know, with my own motivations to actually go up there and be in that audience and feel the emotion was, and it's in the movie.
Mm.
It was a really... was amazing. And so I just keep going back to those people, you know, and the environment, obviously it's important as well, but it's, there's so much potential up there too. And then I think that's right. kind of a good way to close off, is that, that potential for that region to keep its beauty, and for the land itself. You know, if you go back to the Nama people and the Khoi people, they were practicing sustainability long before it ever became a buzzword. You know, that was the way they lived on the land.
100%.
So we need to go back to that as well, you know, and, yeah.
Sure. Fantastic. Oh, dude. By the way, guys, I just want to mention this took like 500 takes. And you can see I forgot to put my tie on. I always do this at these intros at the end of the conversation, so I know what we've discussed. So I think I'll leave this edited on the end. Hope you guys enjoyed it. Love you guys. Please remember, like, subscribe, share, and... have an amazing day. Boos. Finally!